Welcome to episode 91 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and our guest is Martin Walker, joining me to talk about Fatal Pursuit, his latest Inspector Bruno mystery. I love a series, especially one that provides an annual installment. To me, it's like catching up with an old friend, or, as in the case with an Inspector Bruno mystery, a group of friends. And in Bruno's case, a new novel is also like a vicarious vacation to the south of France. What's not to love? There's great food, fascinating history, sublime scenery, wine, and a crackerjack mystery. I apologize in advance for the glitchy recording. Chalk it up to the vicissitudes of technology. Here's Martin Walker. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest today is Martin Walker, who has just released the latest installment in his Inspector Bruno series, Fatal Pursuit. Welcome, Martin.
Hello there.
Fans of Inspector Bruno know that he's passionate about food and wine, hunting, dogs, horses, and of course, women. But for Fatal Pursuit, Bruno needs to find his inner car guy. Talk to me about that inspiration for this story.
Well, this story really began with my eldest daughter, Kate, who is a journalist on the Formula One circuit, you know, these very fast racing cars. And she's going around the world to all of the races. And she asked me if I'd ever heard of what she called the most beautiful car in the world, a famous Bugatti, that four models of this were made in 1936 by Ettore Bugatti, who called it the most beautiful car ever made. It was an extraordinary car, the first production car to go at 200 kilometers an hour. Of these four models, one was bought by Ralph Lauren about 15 years ago for about, I believe, about $12 million. The second one was destroyed in a train crash in France about 50, 60 years ago. The third one was recently bought by the Mullen Auto Museum in California for, we believe, over $37 million, which makes it the most valuable car in the world. And the fourth one disappeared in the Périgord in World War II. So this struck me as an obvious story, an obvious case for Inspector Bruno.
But he's not a car guy, although he, at the beginning of the book, you talk about his, it's a Land Rover, I believe, that he has.
That's right.
That is older.
Well, the Land Rover is older than Bruno. He inherited it from an old hunting friend called Hercule, which is something I talked about I wrote about in the third novel, Black Diamond. And Bruno is not a great car guy. He doesn't particularly enjoy driving fast. He's seen too many car crashes for that. As far as he's concerned, you put gas in one end, water in the other, and the car is meant to get you from A to B. But he's sort of bullied into acting as a navigator for a friend of his who is competing in an important rally race. And Bruno has to navigate the car, control the roll on which the upcoming bends and turns are coming, and all the time being tossed left and right. I actually got a friend of mine, a rally driver in France, to take me around the course at pretty close to rally speed. It was the most terrifying experience of my life, and I've been a journalist in war zones. It was appalling. I was sure we were going to hit into every tree, that we were going to spin off the road. My neck ached from the G-forces. I kept wanting to be sick. It was terrible. And so I wrote all about this for poor old Bruno, who had to go through this kind of thing to help his friend out.
Well, he is, if anything, a good friend and a loyal and participating citizen of Saint-Denis, and that's part of why he is involved in this Concours d'Elegance and the rally races. He wants to help his town have yet another event on its annual calendar.
That's right. That's right. I mean, one of the great problems for a place like the Vézère Valley, which lives increasingly from tourism as the most important industry, is to extend the season beyond the usual summer months. And so the town council comes up with the idea of having this concours d'élégance in the fall, and Bruno has to organize it. And one of the people who comes along is a man called Sylvester, who has a business buying and selling and restoring classic cars. And I have to say, until I began researching all of this, I had no idea of how much money these cars were could be bought and sold for. And this gets us not just into the car business, but also into something else that I came across from some contacts in the French police, which is the concern that these auctions of classic cars were a very easy way for laundering money. And the particular concern is that they could be involved in terrorist finance.
Well, that brings me to the next question, because we've talked about sort of the premise of the story. There's this new activity in Saint-Denis. But there's a lot of action going on behind the scenes of the race and the car show that's brought automobiles and enthusiasts from all over France, from England, from Germany, and a car from the Netherlands. And there are family feuds that span generations and geography. There's teenage bullying that Bruno is trying to take a stand against. And then there's the commemoration of the friendship between the Perigord and Alsace regions that dates from World War II. So when you start a novel, do you have a set of elements that you plan to weave in? Or do you, like you just described, finding out about the potential for funding terrorism through classic car auctions, does it just sort of come as you go along the journey?
Well, I'd always wanted to bring in something of this connection between the Périgord and the Alsace, because in 1940, when the Germans invaded France and they took over both Alsace and Lorraine, they deported hundreds of thousands of people of what they called French stock to replace them with Germans. And almost all of them went down to the Dordogne region. And so people got to know each other, weddings and marriages took place and so on. So every year in my town, we have a formal visit by an Alsace market that's opened in the town to commemorate this tradition. And then while I was actually planning the novel, I was in Paris and talking to an old chum of mine in the French security services, who was talking about various modes of terrorist finance. And one of them that they're worried about is the ease of laundering money through these classic car auctions. So, for example, somebody from the Arab world buys one of these cars, and they can easily be spending $3, $4, $5 million to do so, ships it back to the Arab Emirates or somewhere, changes registration, claiming it's sold to somebody else. That other person brings it back to Europe, sells it, and gets the money, and lo and behold, the money is clean and laundered. So that was also a part of all of this that came in. And it's a serendipity. When you're writing, things suddenly come across your radar screen that fit right in.
I've heard writing described as a journey. You pretty much know the destination, but you have no idea what's going to happen along the way.
That's a very good way of putting it. And I always start with a synopsis, quite a detailed synopsis, but as often as not, I find as I'm writing that the synopsis has to change. But, I mean, I like to have a kind of a route map so I know where I'm going. But as you say, Kurt Vonnegut once said, unexpected travel directions are dancing lessons from God. And that's how I feel about what happens to a book while you're writing it.
That's an even better way of putting it, dancing lessons from God. That's amazing. I read the essay you wrote for Literary Hub on how Europe and the Vézère Valley is in southwest France inspired your writing from the locales to the characters. And you said there was almost too much to cope with. I'm wondering if you can explain that and then share the secret of timing the grilling of a perfect steak.
the Périgord is one of those crossroads of history. It's the place from which we know most about prehistoric mankind, for example, the Neanderthal people, who died out about 30 to 34,000 years ago, because quite near my house is La Terrassie, a very famous cave shelter, where there is where the Neanderthals lived and buried their people. And they buried them, and this is the first time we know this happened, they buried them with ritual and respect. A family lying together, spoon fashion, covered with stones, with very large stones to protect them, and also a very old man who'd clearly been crippled for at least 10 years, unable to feed himself or to hunt for himself, and clearly these people have taken care of this old and helpless person. So it tells us an awful lot about the development of socialization and the way in which we humans learn to become more caring, more thoughtful. And then with the Lascaux Caves, we know more about the prehistory of Cro-Magnon man or Homo sapiens than we do from anywhere else in the world. There's 147 prehistoric sites, 25 painted caves in the Vézère Valley, which is why it's one of the great sites named by UNESCO as a global heritage site. It is not just all the prehistory, it's the Arabs came through there, the Romans were there, the Gauls built a temple there, the Vikings burned down parts of the place, the English were there in the Hundred Years' War, Frenchmen fought Frenchmen in the Wars of Religion, and of course it was quite an important battlefield for the Resistance in World War II. So wherever you turn, there's some element of history there in the Périgord that I find almost overwhelming, but fascinating. And then, of course, there's the food, the wonderful wine, the lifestyle, the climate, the rivers. It's almost too much. But from the policeman in my village, who really inspired the idea of creating the character Bruno, I did learn the secret of grilling the perfect steak, which is you sing the Marseillaise under your breath while you cook it, and then you turn it and sing the Marseillaise again, and you'll have a perfect steak à point.
I have to remember that and brush up on the words.
Well, I'm ready to give lessons if you like.
Bruno's life is populated with ex-lovers. He has an on and off, currently off, love interest, Isabel, who comes to Saint-Denis to investigate one of the crimes that's taking place in the book. Bruno's relationship with Pamela came to an end in The Patriarch, which was your previous novel. And he remains friends with both, but Bruno also is Bruno, and in Fatal Pursuit, he finds another lover. Can you tell us if she is the one?
Well, I don't know. Bruno hasn't told me yet. I tend to doubt it because this is in the course of the rally race and of the Concours d'Elegance, the display of elderly cars that takes place in Saint-Denis, this young woman who's a daughter of a local farmer but who now has a very high-powered job in PR in London, she comes back, she's visiting her family, and she gets the idea of making Saint-Denis or making the Vézère Valley into the site of a different kind of rally with electric cars only, to be a sort of a green, environmentally friendly rally instead of these high-powered gasoline engines. And she and Bruno find one another to be deeply attracting, but Bruno knows perfectly well that her home is in London, her business is there. She only visits Saint-Denis and her parents from time to time. And although she's a very, very attractive woman and equally one who seems to take the initiative in the relationship, Bruno finds it difficult to believe that there's going to be a lasting relationship here. But he's very happy while it lasts.
Well, he seems to have a type. And you've talked about it. He seems to be attracted to women who are strong and independent and highly unlikely to provide him with the family that he really wants. So he's a complicated man in that respect, in the respect of his love life.
He is. Bruno is at heart a cheerful kind of soul, and yet there is this tinge of sadness to his life, which is that he's aching to be a father and to have a family and to raise children with the right woman. But the women for whom he falls, the women to whom he's attracted, tend to be women who focus more on their careers, and this is something that I see more and more in the world today. That one of the aspects of the long overdue the process of women getting equality and pay and opportunities and education and so on is that many of them are less and less ready to settle for the traditional life of being a housewife, a mother, a home carer. They want to use their talents to the full. Bruno's all in favor of that because he finds these women very exciting and very interesting. But it is something that troubles him, that he sees no prospect of becoming a father.
Well, another aspect of the story that I found it was the young man that Bruno takes an interest in, and I mentioned him, Felix was his name, and yeah. It struck me because, without making a huge point of it, you also introduced the fact that France really is a multiracial society, even in smaller villages, and that there's And it gets complicated. It's complicated with this young man, and Bruno sees something in him and steps in. But it struck me with a lot of the things that have been going on in the past year that this is something that isn't new to France.
Well, yes. I mean, I've in the past written about the tensions between the Arab community in France or the Islamic community in France, which of course have been in the headlines a lot over the last year or so, the last couple of years. But equally, there are many other not traditionally French citizens in the country, including one like Felix. His mother is from the Antilles, from the French West Indies. And there are many other French people now whose origins are in sub-Saharan Africa. And you know, they're not Arabs, they're Christians. But I wanted to bring this in because I wanted to show something about the way Bruno acts as a policeman, which is something I've learned from my own friend, Piero, the policeman in my village, which is that he is a young man, almost 16. He's got a series of shoplifting offenses on his background and so on. And Bruno sees this boy as one of his failures. He hasn't been able to get him into his sports teams, to get him into his tennis club, to get him playing rugby, all of the usual way that Bruno has found of developing relationships with the young people in his village. But he realizes that Felix, when he goes to Felix's house, he realizes that the walls are covered in pictures of horses, and he manages to find Felix an after-school and weekend job in a local stables that, of course, is being run by his old flame, Pamela. And Felix turns out to be transformed by the fact that on the one hand, he's got a job. On the other hand, he's being given responsibility. And on the other hand, he's being trusted by somebody. And in the course of this, I found this subplot becoming more and more engaging to me, more and more interesting to me. And I really liked writing this entire part of the novel because it's important, I think, to show that the job of a country policeman like Piero is not just about crime. It's also about prevention of crime. It's also about working with people to help them.
Exactly. It seemed to me that what I was reading was someone who was building a community and helping to strengthen a community. And I think that this is, you know, without being preachy and, you know, sort of saying this is the way you should do it, I thought it was very instructive that it's not just in the big cities, Paris, Los Angeles, New York, that have potential for conflict, but it's much more widespread. And it takes people like Bruno to get down to the root, you know, and try to build things up instead of tearing them down.
Well, that's right, and that's something that I've learned from this friend of mine, who is our village policeman. And I think that the job of being a policeman is obviously a very difficult one, a responsible one, but it's almost too difficult to be left to a traditional paramilitary style of policing, even though obviously the dangers to the police and so on are of paramount importance. And part of the job of being a policeman is to help the community stay together, grow together, improve, develop, to make sure that youngsters are treated with a certain amount of understanding when they are young caraways, because most of us, particularly the boys, have had a bit of the caraway in us in those teenage years when so many kids do get into trouble.
Absolutely. I was really taken with that one aspect of the story, and it became one of my favorites, you know, sort of like, what is Felix going to get up to? And, you know, and I am kind of a car person. I live in Los Angeles, and you have to be kind of a car person here.
Yeah.
I loved the descriptions of the cars, of even the electric cars and the Bugatti, and I enjoyed the story of seeking it. And actually, the resolution, and we won't mention what the resolution is, but it's a lot more complicated than just finding parts of this car. It brings in all these other elements of family and land, and I found the conclusion very satisfactory.
Oh, well, good, thank you. But it also brings in World War II, and everything that I write about this car is based upon historical fact, particularly the way that it was almost certainly being driven by one of two race car drivers of the 1930s, either the Frenchman Robert Benoit, who had been a fighter pilot in the First World War and then became a winner of the French Grand Prix, of the Italian Grand Prix, the Belgian Grand Prix, and his buddy, an Englishman, William Grover Williams, who had won the English Grand Prix, the Belgian Grand Prix, the Italian Targa. And both of them were test drivers for Bugatti. And so, and as well as that, these two men together in World War II set up their own resistance network, which organized parachute arms drops from the Royal Air Force and organized sabotage against the Citroën factories that were producing trucks for the German war machine. And both of them were caught and shot by the Gestapo in the course of the war. So I wanted also to bring in that aspect of reality, that aspect of history, that reminds us just how grim this European history has been, almost within living memory.
I think still within living memory. And I asked you that last year about the patriarch and about the shadow of World War II in Europe, and specifically in this region, France. And my personal feeling is that it's particularly acute now. We're seeing the last of the people who were alive during that time get very, very old. And it's almost like we need to keep living ourselves, because soon living reminders won't be around.
Well, that's true. I mean, my father and my father-in-law and all of my uncles, all of whom fought in World War II, they're all dead now. The French people that I've been talking to about their experiences in the war, they're very old. And yet, you know, it's the echoes of this World War II as a critical moment in European history are still with us. It underpins this whole debate about whether Britain is going to be leaving the European Union with its referendum. It underpins, I think, a great deal of the animosity the Greeks feel for Germany in the Euro crisis, and of course the rather delicate relationship between France and Germany, who really are no longer equals in the size of their economies, and that's a psychological problem for France. And so the history is never really gone. It's still there, even though the actual participants are dying off now.
So back to Bruno, my favorite French policeman. What's next for him? Because I'm certain he has another story, hopefully next year. And I'm just wondering what characters that we met in Fatal Pursuit will be back.
Well, I've written the first draft, and I'm just working at the moment on polishing it and getting the second draft right. And I can tell you that there's a very wonderful castle lying at the heart of it, a castle called Comarc, which is in the Périgord, and it's one of the most extraordinary castles in France. It's a huge one, and it's built upon a great cliff of rock, within which there are prehistoric caves, including 18,000-year-old carvings of horses' heads. And also, it's a castle that was linked to the Templars, the Knights Templar, because the guy who was the constable of this castle, when he went off on the crusade, he entrusted his castle to the Templars. And so we get into all of these Templar memorial enthusiasts, people who believe that there is a Templar treasure still to be found. And and Bruno has to try and sort all of this out. And once again, we get a sort of an echo of some of these terrorist attacks that we've been seeing in France in recent years. So I try and follow the reality of life in France, the news in France, and Bruno has got to try and sort all of this out. And there is a new woman who comes into the picture, but I'm not sure if she's a romantic interest. She's a woman originally, a French-speaking woman from the Caribbean, who is working for the Department of Justice, and her job is to follow Bruno around for 2 weeks, noting down everything that he does as a kind of a time and motion study for what a good country policeman ought to be doing. And this, for Bruno, is just impossible. He couldn't begin to do his usual kind of job of stopping off and drinking and eating and getting to know people while having somebody from Paris watching his every and recording his every move. So this becomes part of the backdrop to it all.
Well, there's a very important question. Does she ride?
No, she doesn't. But she does sing terrific jazz, particularly scat. And Bruno becomes a great admirer of her singing and her love for jazz. And he learns a lot about jazz in the course of these 2 weeks when she's following him around, in the course of which also he has to try and solve a murder, save France and Western civilization and so on. Usual thing for Bruno.
And also put on the perfect dinner party with the proper wine.
Yes, indeed. And although one of the dinner parties that takes place turns out to be extremely delicate and very difficult for Bruno, it's not the food, it's the company.
Oh, gosh. And on that note, we have to wait until next year, and hopefully you'll come back and talk to me about your next book. And you're in the States right now, so we're hoping that there's a book tour that's going to go along with Fatal Pursuit.
Well, there is. I'm doing Washington, D.C., Seattle, San Francisco, Phoenix, Houston. I'm getting around.
Thank you again, Martin Walker, for joining us and for talking about Bruno and France and history and cars and wine and how to grill the perfect steak.
Well, thank you, Nancy. And if you get to France, you'll be able to taste a new wine that we've just launched this year called Cuvée Bruno.
Well, if ever there was an excuse to come to France, that would be it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.